I want to go ahead and get this session started. It's exactly 15 after the hour. We've got a fairly complete panel of people, but I want to leave plenty of time for questions. This is session 333, the two Romneys and their pursuit of the White House. And my name is Newell Bringhurst, and I'm both the moderator of this panel as well as a presenter. And you're probably thinking, probably the people that are not in this session are probably thinking, oh my gosh, not another Romney session. My good friend Dennis. Oh my gosh, Bringhurst again. I mean, that's even worse. But anyway, this is the fourth, the third session I've been involved in, and the fourth session dealing with the Romneys, or Mitt, or George, or a combination of both. And yet to come is, and I should put a plug in here for Grant McMurray, is Grant McMurray is going to be presenting yet another perspective on Mitt Romney. He is the President Emeritus of the Community of Christ, and he's going to be dealing with the rather compelling topic of Joseph Smith meets Mitt Romney. It'll be interesting to see what kind of a perspective Grant McMurray will be presenting on that. So I hope that some of you will be here for that session, that presentation tonight. But let me go ahead and talk a little bit about the format of this session and who the panelists are. Besides myself, I'm going to give the brief bio and the topic that each is going to be talking about. I'll be starting off with a brief introduction overview, comparing and contrasting the two Romneys. It'll be about a 5-minute presentation, and then after I've given my 5-minute presentation, John Hatch, who is an independent scholar, he's a former managing editor of Sunstone, and he is also a published author. He's edited The Danish Apostle, The Diaries of Anthon H. Lund. And he's currently working with Gary Bejera on editing documents of various general authorities during the so-called transition period from 1887 to 1915. And as I say, what John will be presenting is an overview of the history of the Romney family as it relates to their early years, particularly their years in Mexico. That's where, of course, where George Romney was born. And then following John Hatch, we've got J. Bonner Ritchie, who to most Sunstoners hardly needs any introduction. He's a member of the Sunstone Board of Directors, and he has a long, distinguished career. He's actually a professor emeritus of organizational behavior at the Brigham Young University Romney Institute of Public Management. He's been a consultant, a peacemaker, lecturer, who has taught at several universities in the Middle East. And he is, and the reason we got Bonner on the panel, he, along with Sue Bergen, are the authors of a forthcoming biography on George Romney, focusing on George Romney's activities after leaving the political arena. It's a little-known aspect of George Romney's very eventful life, but it was a very important to George Romney, and it was actually the idea of emphasizing voluntarism and citizen involvement in dealing with social and political problems. So that's going to be Bonner Ritchie's presentation. And then he will be followed by Dennis Lithgow. And Dennis Lithgow is a longtime acquaintance of mine. We go all the way back to longer than we either of us probably care to remember, but we were graduate students together at the University of Utah back in the 1960s, and I always seemed to be chasing him in terms of topics and whatever, and just trying to finish up the dissertation. He was ahead of me in the program. He was doing his doctoral dissertation when I was finishing my master's degree, and after he completed a PhD at the University of Utah, he became a professor of history at Bridgewater State College in Massachusetts. And then after living out in Massachusetts for a number of years, he came back to Utah, where he assumed a position with the Deseret News. And he's currently the book editor for the Deseret Morning News. And he's author of four books, including, I think, really a fascinating biography on one of my favorite politicians. I'm just kidding here. J. Bracken Lee. Let 'em holler. That's the name of it, and I don't know if that's still in print or not. It's a fascinating portrait of J. Bracken Lee. And the reason that Dennis is on the panel, he has written two works that are directly relevant to the political activities of George Romney. A very fine PhD dissertation entitled The Changing Image of Mormonism Within Periodical Literature, and that contains really a finely written chapter talking about how the media responded to George Romney throughout his career, not just his presidential run, but going back to from the time he was became the executive CEO for American Motors. And he also published a second essay of Dennis did in BYU Studies, the 1968 Presidential Decline of George Romney. And Dennis will be comparing and contrasting Mitt and George Romney's respective campaigns. Well, I'll start out with my brief overview, and then we'll move in the order that I stated with the other three panelists. And then, unfortunately, you're going to have to bear with me a second time when I give a little my presentation on the lessons learned by George Romney from the failure of his father's campaign. The emergence of former Governor W. Mitt Romney as a major contender for the 2008 presidential nomination triggers memories of Michigan Governor George Romney's abortive quest for the same office back in 1968. The younger Romney's current campaign also invites comparisons with the earlier effort of his father. The parallels between the two Romneys are eerie. In appearance and demeanor, Mitt is clearly his father's son. On the surface, the two men appear to be near clones. And this is the observation of Hugh Hewitt, author of the recently published A Mormon in the White House. Similarities between the two include same business world pedigree, same storybook marriage to his high school sweetheart, same square jaw and large forehead made larger when he flashes that bright white smile and his eyes recede under a heavy brow. Same central casting sweep of black hair with a dose of distinguished white at the temple. Indeed, a striking sense of deja vu is reflected in the backgrounds and life experiences of the two Romneys. Father and son were born exactly 40 years apart. George in 1907 and Mitt in 1947. Each was a fourth child in birth order. Both grew up in devout, close-knit Mormon families. Both fulfilled Latter-day Saint missions abroad, George serving in Scotland and England during the late 1920s. Mitt preached Mormonism in France during the turbulent decade of the 1960s. And then both Romneys achieved success in the business world as turnaround artists. George Romney, as an automobile executive, transformed a failing American Motors Corporation into a profitable enterprise through his introduction of the Rambler, a compact automobile which enjoyed sales success, ensuring survival of the fledgling automaker and making George Romney a wealthy man. Similarly, Mitt Romney achieved even greater monetary success as a venture capitalist, running Massachusetts-based Bain Capital, amassing a personal fortune estimated at some $250 million, making him by far the richest of any of the presidential candidates running this year. In the wake of business success, both Romneys entered the political arena. George, as a Republican, ran for and was elected governor of Massachusetts in 1962. a notable feat in this predominantly Democratic state. The elder Romney proved himself an effective governor and was rewarded by being reelected by increasingly large margins two more times, in 1964 and then again in 1966, because Michigan's governor was a two-year term. That's why he ran three times. Romney's success made him a national figure and established his credentials as a leading contender for the 1968 presidential campaign. Mitt Romney followed his father into the political arena, but unlike the elder Romney, Mitt failed in his first quest for political office, a race for the United States Senate in 1964, in which Romney was pitted against Massachusetts icon Ted Kennedy. 5 years later, in 1999, Mitt Romney took over management of the scandal-ridden United States Olympic Organizing Committee, slated to host the 2002 Salt Lake City Winter Games. He was successful in dealing with this issue and making the Games a premier event, and in fact, turning a profit. Romney then returned to Massachusetts, where he ran for governor in 2002 and was successfully elected as a Republican in this overwhelmingly Democratic state, thereby duplicating the feat of his father exactly 40 years earlier. As governor, he achieved moderate success, erasing a $1.7 billion deficit and pushing enactment of legislation mandating universal health care insurance for all Massachusetts citizens. Thus, by 2006, at the end of his term as governor, Mitt was being touted as a contender for the 2008 Republican presidential nomination, again following in the footsteps of his father. So that's kind of an introduction of kind of comparing the two Romneys. I'm going to let John go, and then we'll go through the panel in the order that I've indicated.
On a clear, mild September day in 1879, a 33-year-old English woman passed away in Salt Lake City, Utah. She left behind seven children and a grieving husband, and curiously, no Utah newspapers carried word of her death or its cause, and this is in a time when the Deseret News is quite religious about publishing weekly the deaths and the obituaries of those who passed on. It might be because her family was too shocked at her premature passing to make any such arrangements, or perhaps they or the community considered her life story a bit too sordid for public mention of her. Her name was also not mentioned in the coverage of her father William's funeral services nearly 8 years later. Her name was Carolyn Lamborn Romney Meekin, the daughter of William and Diana Lamborn, but her name may not have appeared in public because she was also the ex-wife of prominent Mormon Miles Park Romney and the current wife of a non-Mormon, Abraham Meekin. She was raised in Berkshire, England, where her family joined the Mormon Church. She came with them from England to Utah in 1866 when she was 20 years old, but less than a year after her arrival in Zion, Carolyn, or Carrie as she was called, was asked by Miles Park Romney to become his wife, his second wife to be exact. Miles was already happily married to Hannah Hood Hill. Both women were not pleased with the arrangement, but Carrie was especially miserable. She was jealous of Hannah and the attention she got as a first wife from Miles, and also that Hannah's son was named Miles after his father. She also believed that her children received less attention than Hannah's children. For her part, Hannah seemed to think that Carrie, while a beautiful girl, needed to grow up. She recorded that Carrie had frequent temper tantrums and that she was almost like an additional child in the family. Finally, Carrie complained to President Brigham Young, who allowed the union to dissolve, and she left the Romney home and returned to her parents in Salt Lake City, Utah. More than 50 years later, Hannah would claim in her memoir that her husband Miles warned Carrie before she left that she would, quote, marry some low-down Gentile and die an awful death. I believe that Hannah chose to remember it this way is probably more of a testament to her dislike of Carrie than to Miles' prophetic abilities. Now, 140 years after Miles Park Romney's marriage to Carolyn Lamborn, and he and Hannah's great-grandson, Mitt Romney, a prominent Mormon and Republican, has announced he's running for the presidency of the United States. Mitt appears to be the ideal representation of how so many Mormons in the 21st century want to be seen by the American public at large. He's handsome, articulate, and has been pointed out by several political talking heads. He's ironically the only front runner from his party to have been married to just one woman. For many Mormons, Romney has more than one essential qualification. He's a Republican. And like many Republicans for the last several years, Mitt Romney seems to have fallen back on divisive social issues to gain favor with the religious right. The one obstacle, Romney's Mormonism, that is the one thing that seems to stand in his way in some ways. Evangelicals have long been suspicious of Mormonism, and many do not consider it a Christian faith. Therefore, Romney has taken to distancing himself from Mormonism in some ways while embracing those parts that curry favor with the religious right. And unfortunately, Romney is not alone. Many Latter-day Saints seem to think that evangelicals are kindred spirits in a culture they see as sinful and debased. Today, Mormons are politically similar to evangelicals in areas such as gay marriage, abortion, gun ownership, sex education, and other aspects of the culture wars. Mitt Romney himself has himself shifted, sometimes radically, his views on each of these topics to align himself with the religious right. However, I would argue that evangelical Christians and the religious right are one of the last groups Latter-day Saints should be trying to appease. And I'll focus on Mitt Romney's polygamous ancestors now as an example of that rich Mormon heritage that I think he should embrace and not be ashamed of. Miles Park Romney's own life and actions suggest that he approved of civil disobedience to obtain his rights. After Carolyn Lamborn left the Romney family and returned to her parents, Miles Romney asked Catherine Cottom to become his wife, and she agreed in direct violation of U.S. law. Hannah, Miles' first wife, was again heartbroken at having to share her husband, but she busied herself around the Romney home to prepare for the new wife to distract herself, and she later recalled that that helped ease her pain. But only a short time later, she gave birth to a stillborn baby and blamed herself for her overexertion and her stress at the addition of a second wife, believed that's why the baby died. But after Catherine arrived, Hannah was surprised to find that she was nothing like Carrie, and they got along quite well. It's easy to view the battle over Mormon polygamy in the 19th century as one institution versus another. But the full crushing weight of the federal government came bearing down on families and people, including Miles Park Romney and his family. And he had taken a third wife in 1877, Annie Woodbury Romney. In 1881, at the behest of their church, they moved to St. John's, Arizona, to establish another Mormon colony near the New Mexico border. A few years later, the anti-polygamy raids began. Miles was arrested and sent to Prescott, Arizona, to stand trial on charges of perjury, while charges of cohabitation remained pending. After he was acquitted, he fled and was encouraged by LDS President John Taylor to, quote, get out of the way for a time. Late one night, while adolescents and toddlers slept in a meager dwelling, federal marshals pounded on the door of the Romney home, guns drawn and handcuffs ready. Hannah explained that her husband had gone, and the marshals retorted that he would only further his trouble, and they threw in for good measure that he was just costing the government too much money by fleeing. The marshals returned frequently, coming and going as they pleased in their hunt for Miles and other polygamists. After the first midnight visit, though, Hannah took her son's clothes, sewed all the money she had in them, and sent the boy to find his father in Prescott. And by now, additional wives were also liable to be prosecuted, and so Catherine and Annie had left and were living in Snowflake, Arizona. Miles went to Salt Lake and asked church leaders what should be done, so he was gone and then later fled. Hannah had 9 children to care for on her own in the harsh winter of 1884 and 1885. Her son Miles Jr. nearly froze to death while returning from a distant job to try and raise money for the family. And so her husband made the crucial decision to leave the United States and flee to Mexico. The Romney family was then split 3 ways. Catherine went to St. George, Utah to live with her parents. Hannah remained in St. John's, Arizona with her 9 children. And Annie and Miles went to Mexico together. And they remained separated for over a year, and each group struggled in their own way. But nobody probably more so than Hannah, who was on her own. She had to fight every night just to keep her children warm and fed. And when they finally made the journey a year later to rejoin her husband in 1886, it was in the middle of the winter. She and her children huddled together in blizzards, and one child actually remained barefoot until Deming, New Mexico, near the border. Throughout the journey, Hannah felt touched by the hand of God. She recounted just missing Indians on the warpath, discovering an abandoned cabin just when all hope was nearly snuffed out, and even rescuing her beloved stove from certain doom once they reached Mexico. A year later, after she arrived, Hannah sent word to St. George that they were ready for his second wife to join his first and third wives, and so they were reunited again. They hoped that they could live in peace and practice what their contemporary saw as an offensive, disgusting form of marriage. No parallels there today. During the ordeal, Miles Romney's grandfather, Gaskell, was 14 when he marched over 350 miles with his mother, Hannah, to reunite with his father. Gaskell spent several years in Mexico as the family helped settle additional Mormon colonies. He married Mitt's grandmother, Anna Amelia Pratt, who is a granddaughter of Parley P. Pratt, in Dublin, Mexico, 10 years after walking there with his family. Their son, George Romney, Mitt's father, was also born in Mexico in 1907 in the Mormon polygamous colonies. When George was 18, his mother died, and a year later Gaskell married her sister, and they were sealed in the Salt Lake Temple by Anthony W. Ivan. So Gaskell himself became a polygamist in the Mormon afterlife sense. Through all of his ordeals, Miles Park Romney remained committed to a form of marriage despised by an entire country. He remained so committed, in fact, that 7 years after the LDS Church announced through the Woodruff Manifesto that it had abandoned plural marriage, Miles took Millie Snow as his fourth wife and joined the elite ranks of Mormons who became post-manifesto polygamists. He, like all other polygamists, broke the law to follow his beliefs and fled from U.S. laws criminalizing cohabitation and polygamy. I am troubled that Mitt Romney wishes to trivialize the sacrifices of his ancestors by labeling polygamy, quote, awful, and turning his back on the uniqueness of his Mormon faith. At least that's my perception of what he's done. But sadly, he is merely a public face of what has been happening for the last several years in Mormonism. Latter-day Saints seem to want acceptance and validation at the expense of their unique and often peculiar doctrines and past. The official church, so paranoid at the inference of shows like Big Love and News Stories, issues a press release anytime someone publicly uses the phrase Mormon fundamentalist, insisting there is no such thing. Instead, the church unites with evangelical Christians to campaign against gay marriage, while many members cry out for the banning of evolution in schooling. I would hope that my people are better than the outspoken evangelicals that appear in films like Jesus Camp. I would also hope that we are better than the creepy practice of purity balls or the mind-numbingly stupid creationist museums that are popping up. Mitt Romney has demonstrated that he is an extremely capable leader, and he really is, I believe, and it could be a superb public face for Mormonism, but instead he seems to be becoming a caricature of the Christian right. I believe he would find more success by embracing his Mormonism, including the lessons of its past, rather than minimizing it and forcing it to resemble mainstream evangelicalism. Thanks.
I would like to make my remarks a little more personal and intimate than archival. My first encounter with George Romney came when I was interviewing at the University of Michigan for a position in 1967. And a colleague in Ann Arbor told me that George Romney made one proud to be a Mormon in Michigan. And I really didn't know Romney at that time, but had seen a little bit about him in the press. And that was kind of an interesting perspective, because seldom did I hear that kind of comment in universities with respect to Mormonism. I took the position. I went to Michigan and was there for 6 years, from 67 to 73. And my first personal encounter with Romney came in the late summer, early fall of 1967, when Detroit was in flames with the race riots that were rather dramatic. 12th Street in Detroit was literally in flames. I remember looking from the top floor of the General Motors building, and it really did look like Rome burning. It was a scary sight. And the impressive thing was that Governor Romney was there, was walking the streets, was sleeping in the police station on 12th Street, was talking to people, approaching store owners, rioters, protesters, sensitive, problem-solving, committed on the front line. And one of the legacies of George is that he was a fix-it man. Newell mentioned the notion that both he and Mitt are turnaround artists, and that's true. They both love to find crises and solve them. Sometimes they create the crisis in order to solve it. But they both love to be involved in dramatic, high-pressure situations, especially involving money, budgets, social issues, whatever. But here was George in shirt sleeves, walking the streets fast. He always walked fast. He was a very impatient sort of guy, impatient to the point of obsession, but trying to deal with the problem. And a little later, when Detroit won the World Series in a classic showdown with St. Louis, and I was at the game when Governor Romney was there, and Gates Brown, who is a utility player for the Detroit Tigers, commented that George Romney was the most important force for solving racial problems in America. Gates Brown was black, and so it was kind of an interesting endorsement. The next encounter came at a state conference when just following the assassination of Martin Luther King, and George was governor, but he had been the first state president of the Detroit State when it was organized, and Newell knows when. I can't remember when that was, but it was for several years, over 10 years, he was the state president, and did a lot for the church in that area, building chapels and acquiring property. Was, again, very aggressive. And at the state conference, there was a visiting general authority and the state president and the regular speakers. Nobody mentioned a thing. And then George reached over to the visiting authority, and I can't remember who it was. I should go back to my diary. And mentioned that he wanted to talk, and if George wanted to talk, he talked. And so George got up and gave this absolutely stirring, emotional tribute to Martin Luther King. It was really touching. People were in tears. It was a very moving account of a person committed to something that everybody didn't necessarily share. Martin Luther King was not the most popular American at that time. And George's endorsement and eulogy were powerful in a way that I hadn't experienced in a state conference before on a civil rights issue. Along with that, one of the newsworthy stories of the time was George's resignation from the Detroit Athletic Club. And those of you from Michigan, from Detroit, know that the Detroit Athletic Club is the seat of power of the American automobile industry. At least it was. It's not now. Now it's in Tokyo. But at that time, it was the Detroit Athletic Club. And they discriminated in their membership practices with a vengeance. And when this came to light, George resigned with a blast against organizations that discriminate. And it was interesting because the editorial in the Detroit Free Press came back with, what about his own church in terms of discrimination? But years later, when Newell mentioned we were doing interviews for a book on George, which is finished and awaiting publication, we interviewed the director of the Romney Volunteer Center in Detroit, a very powerfully effective black woman, who had tears in her eyes when she described the fact that it didn't matter if George's church discriminated. George didn't, and he was the most important force for civil rights in the area, and she not only endorsed but lined up behind George and in terms of bringing justice in a very troubled area in Detroit, as the World War II auto industry recruited black workers from the South, and they had a terribly difficult time, and George was just this incredible force, and that it didn't matter what the church said, it was his behavior that made a difference. There's lots of other issues with George. As I interviewed 75 people in America, including ex-president of the United States and several business tycoons, in every case, the feeling that came across was one of passion for George Romney. The feeling that comes across with Mitt is efficient manager. The feeling that came across with George was passionate leader. And there's a real difference in terms of a perspective. And I couldn't believe, as I would sit in boardrooms in New York and hear these billionaire real estate tycoons say that George Romney was their inspiration for a whole series of things that they had done. Originally for joining his Volunteers in America and the Points of Light Foundation, which the president of which said George was the inspiration for it, and Colin Powell, who said George was the absolute inspiration. When Colin Powell received the George Romney Award from the Points of Light Foundation, he said that George was the most inspiring leader in America that he had ever known. This is a fairly substantial leader himself. This was before he was Secretary of State. But when he formed his organization, I can't remember the name of it, the Little Red Wagon, what was it called? The Little Red Wagon logo for reaching out to young kids in America. Is that? Anyway, Colin Powell said that George was his inspiration and was the force, and called him the father of contemporary volunteerism in American life. And of the legacies that George leaves, the fix-it person is clearly one, but the more dominant one is public service. And Mitt has worked very hard to live up to his father's ideal and dream of public service and to vindicate his father's run for president. It's an emotion that is visible in interviewing and talking to Mitt. But public service started with George very early. His first foray into politics was working as an aide to a Democratic senator from Massachusetts, so Walsh, in Washington, and then he went to work for Alcoa as a lobbyist, and then he went to Detroit. And a lot of people don't realize that George Romney is the person that mobilized the United States automobile industry in its transformation from making silly cars to airplanes, tanks, and trucks for the military. It was George irritated some people. He irritated Henry Ford, he should have been irritated with the fact that the auto industry had a civic public service responsibility to move into war production. And in the Ypsilanti plant of Ford, that George single-handedly turned from making Fords to making airplanes, to this day, it's a dramatic story that people tell, as that airport was built to fly off those fighter planes that Ford reluctantly agreed to make. Ford didn't think we should be in the war and was actually a closet Nazi supporter and was very troubled by the United States attack against Germany. He was supportive of our attack against Japan. There was a racial dimension there that has come out in several interviews I've done. But so we should fight Japan, but not Germany. But at any rate, George was this force. He never would give up. It was his dogged sort of impatience and persistence that dominated his life. It was a short-term mentality. He had a short attention span. He would get into something and then move on to something else. And he left the Automobile Manufacturers Association and went to work for Nash Kelvinator and was very impatient there. Mason, who was the CEO, but Mason saw a potential powerhouse here and made him president, and George discontinued the primary activities of Nash Kelvinator, the refrigerators and the Nash car and the Hudson, Those of you who remember Nashes and Hudsons and Kelvinators appreciate the fact that one day George says we're done. And we're going to start doing something dramatically different. The adventure, the sense of excitement of saying we're going to discontinue these massive lines that we've been doing, and we're going to start making this silly little car a Rambler. And he took on the gas-guzzling dinosaurs of Detroit and totally aggravated not only Henry Ford again, but his grandson, Edsel, who had the short term, and then Henry. Everybody was just irritated, but the Rambler became the third top-selling car in America very quickly and was the revolutionary force that inspired Toyota with their production system, with a type of car that would sell. And Toyota executives are really interesting as they talk about the process by which they learned what might work in America. And the Rambler worked, and the Toyota has worked. But George then moved on, and the Detroit schools were in a crisis, which, again, those of you from the area will realize is a recurring phenomenon. And George accepted the invitation from the mayor to be chair of the Detroit Public School Advisory Committee and totally restructured the Detroit Public Schools, their budget system. It was a massive effort with very little praise and very little acknowledgement, but he restructured the whole Detroit public school system. And then, again, with his management and fiscal kind of obsession, said that the state of Michigan was in a disaster and needed to be changed. The problem was the Constitution. And so George, again, single-handedly put together a Constitutional Revision Commission for Michigan, Citizens for Michigan, organized it, walked the streets, recruited people involved, and including the president of the United Auto Workers, who had replaced Walter Reuther that time, and as I interviewed him, he said, George was the hardest man to turn down I had ever seen. He said, if you turned him down, he would be back in an hour with another argument, and he never asked for an appointment. He just stormed into your office, and it didn't matter who you were, President of the United States, President of the United Auto Workers, or a corporate executive, or whatever. And he said he was just there and demanding your attention, demanding your involvement. And he said there's no way you could get out of it. He said you just had to sign on to whatever George was doing. And so they wrote a new constitution for Michigan, and it became fairly controversial, but a lot of people saw it as worthwhile. And as a result of doing this, George really was involved in the service side, and he even turned down the chairmanship of the commission. He was a force behind the scene, but he didn't demand the public honor. But then after this was done, and then it was going to be put to a vote of the citizens of Michigan, he was afraid it was going to lose, and so he said, I didn't hear this. I heard other people say he said it, but I've got to run for governor. I've got to be governor in order to make sure this damn thing passes. That's a quote from the head of the Republican Party in Michigan at the time that George was running. And so he ran for governor and won by a very small margin against a very popular young Democrat, war hero. He won, and then, as Newell said, won two more terms, as he did all kinds of things, but over the opposition of his Republican minority in the Michigan legislature. And I interviewed a Democratic senator from that time who said George Romney was the best Democrat Michigan's ever had. And he was the only Democrat. He was the only Democrat elected to public office in that first election. Did you validate that, Newell? Is that your...
You mean Republican.
Only Republican elected.
He was the first Republican elected in many...
But the only one in that election.
In that election.
And I wasn't there then. But that was in 62, but that was a fun story. Well, anyway, and then George had his presidential campaign, which I think Newell and Dennis are going to say more about. But after he served as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Nixon cabinet for one term, he left very critical of Richard Nixon. And I read the draft copy. George's papers are in the library at the University of Michigan, and I spent a couple of weeks there reading these papers. They're not organized. It's just pure chaos, as was George's life in terms of this kind of thing. And everything was handwritten on yellow pads, and there are 5,000 boxes of yellow pads of notes. But one of them was his resignation letter to Richard Nixon, and it was so telling, sort of an indictment of a failure to honor the public trust. And this was after Watergate sort of hit the news, but while Nixon was still pretty popular and was reelected. But his statement of public service and loyalty and commitment and dignity was so touching and so telling as he articulated that. During his presidency, he worked hard on increasing volunteerism in American life and did some things. But then after his cabinet service, George really did become the father of modern volunteerism in American life. He said that we should have a volunteer center in every city with the same frequency as we have post offices. That the three branches of life, government, business, and volunteerism. Volunteerism was the most important in solving the country's ills, the world's ills. And he was a continual advocate for volunteer centers, for programs, for activities that would mobilize public support for doing things that government couldn't do and that business wasn't inclined to do. And the Points of Light Foundation, which has become the dominant organization in America for mobilizing volunteer service, owes its founding and its mission and its legacy to George Romney. After it was set up, and George Herbert Walker Bush adopted the Points of Light as one of his themes, and gave credit to George as the inspiration for that, they organized a president's summit in Kennebunkport, Massachusetts. And George is the one that did it. He said, you guys have got to get together, and we've got to have a crusade for volunteerism in American life, and got to get these former presidents together. And would have been Carter and Bush and Clinton and who? Was Reagan still alive?
Yep.
And Reagan. And so they came to Kennebunkport, and they were waiting for George to show up. And George was always prompt and always on time. And they asked the security at the... This was when Clinton was president. Asked if Romney had showed up and been... There's a problem. And somebody heard scuffling in the kitchen. And George was in the kitchen cooking breakfast for the four presidents, and had snuck in around security and gone in and said that the domestic help was not doing its job, and so he took over and was preparing some food for this group. And the summit was a brilliant success. George died before the outcome, really, before things really were realized. But it was a rallying clarion call in American life to people, for people to get involved. Well, that's a few reflections on George Romney. The legacy he leaves for me are, first of all, public service. George did not cater to anybody. He was terribly outspoken, not the best speaker in the world, but enormous passion. He always talked too long, but he always had something to say, and he always had enthusiasm, and his commitment was unwavering, and it was so clear what he believed and what he wanted to do. And he never catered to any subgroup. He never catered to any, and he didn't get along at all with the Republican right. In fact, as I'm sure everybody knows, he absolutely refused to endorse Barry Goldwater in his presidential campaign, and wrote letters saying that Goldwater does not deserve to be president. And he didn't become president. But Nelson Rockefeller tried to get George to run against Goldwater. George turned that one down and then picked it up later. And others will talk about this. And then Rockefeller kind of withdrew his support. And that was a shattering experience for George, because he thought that George was the front runner in America for the presidency against Lyndon Johnson in 68, in the early part of the campaign. But that legacy of public service, saying what you think, doing what you think is right, changing his mind on Vietnam. And it's kind of ironic that George was an original supporter of Vietnam, and most of the country was still supportive of Vietnam in 1968. And when George turned against the war, one of the primary influences was Martin Luther King. And all of you who remember Martin Luther King's classic Riverside Church speech, where he incorporated the anti-war into his civil rights crusade in a very dramatic move, and that was very influential for George. And then he went to Vietnam, and the famous brainwashing statement that the generals had tried to brainwash him. And he changed his mind. And it was ironic that at a time when the war was popular, George was against it. Now, with an unpopular war, Mitt is for it. And that's kind of an interesting juxtaposition because George never catered to public opinion. He never catered to polls. I doubt that he ever took a poll. I don't know. Maybe Dennis knows or maybe Neil knows. I doubt that George just wasn't that part of it. He said, I'll do my thing. If people like it, fine. If they don't, tough. But he took that stand in terms of public service, in terms of budget, fiscal responsibility. He turned Michigan's massive deficit, the largest deficit of any state in the country, around in 2 years, was just an absolutely brilliant financial manager, as is Mitt. And so the idea of public service, of fiscal responsibility and fix it kinds of things, and commitment to principle. And that's the legacy of George Romney that I wish some of the rest of us, especially those running for president, could adopt.
Well, I'd like to dwell on the differences between George and Mitt when we look at the two campaigns. And I think that Bonner has given us a good introduction to that by saying that George was a passionate leader and Mitt was an efficient manager. I like that. That fits it to a T, I think. It also represents one of the difficulties that George had in running for president, and that it was his very strong piety. He was a religious man, and he wore it on his sleeve. You could tell it, and people who wrote about it noticed that this was a very pious man, and they weren't sure that a president should be that religious. For instance, some of the references that I found in looking at the press accounts of George's campaign said that he was a self-righteous sermonizer, a ceremonial high priest, a Bible-quoting broth of a man, and a lot of other descriptive terms. And, of course, the most famous joke that came out of the campaign in this sense was George and his lieutenants having a meeting one afternoon, and they came out after it was over, and his aide said, "Beautiful day, Governor," and Romney said, "Thank you." and so a lot of people thought that he was using the presidency as a stepping stone, and That was a little bit irritating. Mitt, as far as I've been able to determine, does not come off that way. I haven't noticed any press accounts that talk about his piety in the same way that they talked about George. They know he's religious and that he is different, that Mormonism is whatever the biases say it is. But Mitt tries to stay away from doctrinal kinds of things when he's speaking, and he tries not to give a sermon. That sort of image sticks pretty well. I don't know whether that's because he thinks that his dad made that mistake or whether that's because that's the way he is. But some people still think he's got the piety. Last Sunday, I read Frank Rich's column in the New York Times about Romney, and I thought the most telling statement was, "Piety often goeth before fall. There had better not be any skeletons in his closet," meaning Mitts. So when you've got someone who is very religious, you wonder, is this the real guy? And are there secrets that we're going to find out sometime? And so a lot of people fear that sort of thing. But Mitt speaks with high confidence. He just doesn't seem to compare to a minister, at least not yet. That hasn't come out yet. The second thing that I notice is that George was questioned quite a lot about blacks in the priesthood, which, of course, was the key issue that was that critics and the press observed in Mormonism, and especially for someone who was running for president. But George was able to fend that off fairly effectively by his own civil rights stance. And he had been pro-civil rights in Michigan, and he was very much in the forefront of that movement. And so that seemed to sort of neutralize the black and the priesthood issue, which really at the time was a very controversial one within the church as well. Mitt has different kinds of problems. He's asked all kinds of strange doctrinal questions that I wouldn't have predicted. And he always tries to get rid of it by saying, I'm not a spokesman for the church. And if you want a direct explanation of Mormon doctrine, talk to church leaders. And I think that's a pretty good answer. But they won't let him do that. For instance, I watched him on ABC's George Stephanopoulos Sunday program not too long ago. And Stephanopoulos asked him about the New Jerusalem and the Second Coming with respect to Mormon doctrine, and wondered how that would adversely affect Mitt Romney as president in terms of Mideast foreign policy. I thought, wow, you know, that's kind of stretching the issue. And Mitt gave the first answer, I'm not a spokesman for the church. And Stephanopoulos wouldn't relent. He said, yeah, but you've been a bishop and you've been a state president. You've been equivalent of a pastor over large congregations of Mormons. So if anyone knows Mormon doctrine, you should. And so then Mitt answered it, and according to a lot of Mormons, answered it wrong. He talked about the New Jerusalem and said, yeah, we're not any different on that than other Christians. And Christ is returning to Jerusalem, and that's the way it is. And then Mormons started writing letters to the Deseret News saying, well, doesn't Mitt know LDS doctrine? And then some of the press said, well, I don't think, I mean, this is a kind of generalization that I noticed several of them observed, that maybe Mitt purposely answered that way because it would be less hassle. But they doubted that he didn't know it. Or that he didn't know the doctrine. The third point that I'd mention is that George was the clear front runner in 1968. You go all through the press accounts in 1967 and you see Romney. He was a very interesting, powerful man, and he seemed morally a good choice. After Lyndon Johnson, you know, I mean, it would be easy to say, let's have somebody like George Romney. But it appears that the country wasn't quite ready for that. But he was the front runner, and his picture was on all kinds of major magazine covers. And there were big stories, many of them very positive about the effect he might have as president. And so it was really sort of his to lose, and he lost it. And when he realized his poll ratings were going down in New Hampshire, he pulled out before the New Hampshire primary and sort of gave the nomination to Richard Nixon. A lot of people were angry at that. They thought he got out too early, and maybe he did. But he didn't want to be a loser, especially in the first primary, and be measured that way. Mitt is often referred to roughly as a front runner. I think we could say he's sort of a front runner. He's been very interested in becoming the front runner, but he's having a very hard time doing it. The problem is that when he there is a poll nationally about Romney's standing, he comes out in the single digits. Early on, it was 3%, then it was 4%. The last I heard, it was 8%. This is just before the Iowa and New Hampshire people start going to vote, and when they're polled, he does much better. He's leading in Iowa and New Hampshire. Not a lot, but he's leading. And so if he were to win in those two states, then maybe that would change. But I think it's a danger sign to him that, nationally speaking, he only gets 8% of Republicans. That may have something to do with the fact that in other polls have shown that a third of American voters would not vote for any Mormon for president. If you say a third of the electorate will not vote for you because of your religion, that's getting rid of a huge amount of people that you need in order to be elected. I think that the fourth point is that George was really not sure at first about running for president, and he kind of slipped into it, whereas Mitt has planned this for a long time. Even though he didn't want to talk about it very early, you see all the signs now that he ran for president almost full time for the last 2 years that he was governor of Massachusetts. So he really only spent 2 years really fully functioning as governor. In the third and fourth year, he was running for president. He was out of the state almost all the time in those last 2 years. Well, that's an effective way to run. It suggests that his organization is good. His fundraising is phenomenal. So the efficiency idea comes back. A fifth one that I would mention is that I think that Romney, on just a personal kind of level, campaigning, shaking hands, probably does better than his dad did. He seems a little more down to earth, a little more reachable. He's pretty good at answering questions. I would like to see. I always look for this in any candidate. You know, where's the humor? Where's the wit? Well, I don't think there's any wit in either Romney. But on the other hand, I've thought there's a wit has been sadly lacking in recent years for any presidential candidate. So the closest maybe that Romney came to it is when he went to campaign in Rhode Island at the beginning of the campaign, and he said, "Ann, in your wildest dreams, did you ever see me up in Rhode Island campaigning for Republicans?" And Ann said, "Mitch, you weren't in my wildest dreams." Well, you know, that's kind of cornball, but you know, a little more of that might bring him down to earth. A sixth point is that whereas George was popular in Michigan when he ran for president, Mitt was not popular in Massachusetts and could not have been reelected, in my opinion. And that's the big reason that he chose not to run for reelection. It would have been embarrassing to lose for reelection to the governorship. He managed to offend just about every interest group in the state while he was governing, and he did it particularly on a basis of cutting the budget in various ways. George governed hard for three terms in Michigan, and Mitt started running for president fairly early. That's a significant difference. And George was a moderate Republican, more in the Nelson Rockefeller mode, and William Scranton mode, at a time when that sort of thing was acceptable, and when Republicans could be either moderate or conservative. Now they're only conservative. And so Mitt is only conservative, and we don't know whether that's the actual truth or not, because he's flip-flopped on so many issues. In order to be in the right position, in order to get the conservative Republican support. I've got to quit. I just have... I want to refer briefly to two articles that I read just yesterday in the New York Times, one by Adam Nagorny. This is a fairly lengthy article about Romney, but I think the first part of it is very interesting. In the days leading up to the Iowa straw poll, which is today, Mr. Romney, the former Massachusetts governor, has come under a furious assault from some of his rivals and the powerful network of abortion opponents in this state. And he's had a couple of real confrontations with talk show hosts, conservative talk show hosts, who question his true devotion to conservatism. And one of them took him to task for maybe not being such a good Mormon because of his previous position on abortion. And so these people are starting to think, you know, pretty deeply on this. He has been pummeled in videos on YouTube in automated telephone calls, in daily barrages of email to lists of Republican caucus voters, and on the airwaves of the state's conservative talk radio network. In almost all cases, the attacks are built on the idea that because Mr. Romney became an opponent of abortion rights only relatively recently, he cannot be counted on as a committed social conservative. I think that's something that's probably going to get worse before it gets better as he tries to answer that question. And then the other is David Brooks, who was a conservative commentator, wrote, I think, the most interesting thing I've seen so far on Romney. This is just yesterday. Mitt Romney was talking about the global economy and was asked why he thought some nations grow rich and others don't. He said there are at least two schools of thought on this question, one associated with Jared Diamond of UCLA, which emphasizes natural resources, and another associated with the Harvard historian David Landis, which emphasizes culture. Over the next several minutes, he weaved in the two theories, siding a bit more with Landis. The answer demonstrated an ability to handle contradictory information streams. From it, you could see how Romney had managed to graduate with honors from Harvard Law School while graduating in the top 5% of his class at Harvard Business School. You could see how he managed to start Bain Capital and turn it into a $4 billion firm, doubling the return on investment every single year. You could see how he turned around the Salt Lake City Olympics and passed bipartisan health care reform in Massachusetts. You could also see a natural theory for his presidential campaign. Romney would be Mr. Execution. Get it done. Instead, Romney has highlighted ideology and molded himself to fit the GOP electorate. And so, you know, Brooks is saying he's done it all wrong. He's defeating himself because he ought to be pointing out that here is a guy who can do the job, that he's smart, and that he's efficient, and he can become an outstanding president. But instead, he wants to make sure that he believes all the right things on all the right issues. And so the question there is, what are his principles? Does he actually have them? I'll stop there.
I guess the, what I'm going to be focusing on is what lessons, kind of piggybacking a little bit on some of the things that Dennis has suggested, what lessons can be learned from George Romney's failed 1968 campaign, lessons that have been picked up by his son, Mitt Romney. And I should note that Richard Eyer, I don't know how many you've heard of him. I don't know too much about him, but he's a well-known Latter-day Saint self-help expert, the author of some 25 books, and he was a veteran of George Romney's campaign. How many have heard of Richard Eyer? Okay, he was a veteran of George Romney's 1968 campaign, and in his master's thesis, which he wrote at Brigham Young University, and which was completed in 1969, just after the campaign itself, he made a list of 20 reasons why George Romney's campaign failed. And I should mention something that was not on the list. This might surprise you: the issue of his Mormon religion. That wasn't on Eyer's list of all. But it did include the circumstances related to George Romney's notorious brainwashed on Vietnam statement. Now, Mitt Romney has carefully studied Eyer's thesis. In fact, Eyer made a point of getting a copy to Romney. They apparently know each other because Eyer's lived back in Massachusetts. And in considering the issue of his father's brainwashing statement, Mitt stated the following when he looked at it. He said, "This told me that you have to be very, very careful in how you choose in your selection of words. And it's something that I've become attuned to because Dad fell into the quagmire of not being so careful." The elder Romney was undoubtedly honest and forthright in expressing his feelings concerning the Vietnam War, thereby reflecting his blunt, forthright, from the heart style of speaking, which Bonner, you know, made some references to. Mitt Romney, by contrast, is very careful, very nuanced in both his speaking, in both his statements and his speaking style. Certainly not forthcoming from Mitt Romney as a statement critical of American involvement in Iraq, saying we've been brainwashed on Iraq. You won't hear Mitt Romney saying that, or calling for America's immediate withdrawal, as George did during his campaign relative to Vietnam. Although Mitt Romney has expressed carefully worded criticism of American officials for their failure to adequately deal with post-war problems in Iraq, kind of a little straddling that a little bit. A second lesson that Mitt learned from his father's 1968 failure is the absolute necessity, and this kind of goes a little with what Dennis was saying at the end of his thing, absolute necessity of appealing to the Republican Party's conservative base. The elder Romney attempted to secure the Republican nomination in 1960 by running as a moderate, running to the left of his major opponent, Richard Nixon. This was a major mistake, given that the Republican Party had become increasingly conservative in its ideology during the decade of the 1960s. This occurred despite the overwhelming defeat of Barry Goldwater in 1964, whom George Romney, has been pointed out, refused to endorse, which was which came back to bite him, came back to haunt George Romney. So when George Romney ran, he found himself isolated from the Republican Party's increasingly conservative base. Now, by contrast, Mitt, who was elected governor in 2002 as a moderate on certain social issues, including abortion, stem cell research, gay rights, and gun control, shifted his position on these issues, moving to the right, thus reflecting his desire to validate his credentials with the Republican Party's conservative base, and possibly also with the religious evangelical right. A third lesson Mitt learned from his father was the timing of his formal announcement that he was actually running for president. The elder Romney did not formally announce his candidacy until November of 1967. Even though the elder Romney had began the process of organizing his campaign many months earlier than that. This delay caused George Romney to appear indecisive, or as Mitt himself recalled, quote, "My dad never seemed to have made up his mind he was getting in. It was always, well, I haven't made a final decision. My father wasn't certain." By contrast, Mitt, who formally announced his candidacy in January of 2007, declared, "Well, I'm not that way at all. I've made my decision and I'm in it with both feet." Lesson number four is that the younger Romney learned from his father was his father's inability to exclusively focus his undivided attention on his presidential campaign because he was still Michigan governor. Romney's schedule as overloaded schedule as governor made it difficult as he tried to govern Michigan and run for the presidency at the same time. In addition, the elder Romney's responsibilities increased in the wake of the Detroit riots of 1967. All of this prevented Romney from being adequately briefed by a group of foreign and domestic policy experts whom his campaign had carefully assembled. As a result, George demonstrated a lack of preparedness on foreign and domestic issues, this leading to his notorious brainwashed statement. By contrast, Mitt Romney declined to run for a second term as Massachusetts governor. I think Dennis is probably onto something when he suggests that he probably would have been defeated, you know, but I think there was also the added factor. Maybe he didn't intend to do so anyway because he could, you know, tout this as his, you know, as he he'd served in an executive political position and he didn't have that intention of, even from the beginning, but I guess that's a point of debate. But, you know, and so as a result of no longer being Massachusetts governor, he's able to give his campaign the clear, undivided focus. But I think an even more fundamental, perhaps even the more basic lesson that George Romney learned from his father was the absolute importance of a carefully, well-organized, coherent campaign organization, along with having a clearly and explicit campaign strategy. Although the elder Romney, George, appears to have had a well-organized campaign, at least on paper, he was plagued with this organization of George was plagued with a number of fatal flaws. A basic problem was the elder Romney tried to establish two centers of operation, a headquarters in Washington, D.C., under the direction of a veteran campaign operative by the name of Leonard Hall, and a Michigan-based organization known as Romney Associates, run by a younger group of individuals with different philosophies and ideas from those of Leonard and these more senior aides. As a result, there was tension, there was conflict, division, competition within the campaign, as these two factions, instead of working together, tended to work against each other. Worse still, There was really no working, and as a result, there was really no working organization and functioning campaign framework and structure. I'm quoting the words of Richard Iyer. Even more basic as a problem was, and I think this is as equally important, and maybe is the lack of an overall strategy. Instead, campaign operatives and the candidate responded to problems and issues as they arose without a clear coherent strategy, lurching from crisis to crisis, problem to problem. The campaign just floundered. By contrast, Mitt Romney has established and put into place a carefully organized and coordinated campaign structure, operating on both the national and the state level, one that is in fact vastly superior to that of Rudy Giuliani, John McCain, and Fred Thompson. And I think you could, and he's also developed a well thought out campaign strategy, gaining name recognition through massive and well coordinated media advertising. He's raised more funds than any other candidate, and to be able to do this massive media advertising, and he's doing this in order to gain name recognition. And on the grassroots level, the strategy is focused on winning first in the Iowa caucuses, and I guess part of the way onto the way to that process is the straw poll that's taking place today, to give him the cachet that he is indeed a winner or a front runner in Iowa. And then the New Hampshire primary. With the momentum from these two victories, carrying the candidate to victories in later primaries, all of this leading to securing the Republican nomination. Such careful organizing and strategic planning on the part of Romney has caused one veteran GOP observer to state the following. I think today, to date, Romney's running the smartest campaign. They've won the money race. As I say, they've raised more than any other candidate. They're organizing and advertising in the early primary states, and they're putting dollars on the air, and the candidate has made very few mistakes. He's performed well in the debates. You've got to give them high marks to date. Whether or not Mitt Romney's well-organized campaign succeeds in getting him the ultimate prize, I guess ultimately remains to be seen. Thank you. Okay, we've got, how much time do we have? We've got about 10 minutes. Is that 15 minutes? We've got about 15 minutes for questions. Would you please come to the microphone and direct your question to whoever you want to answer it or whatever. Yeah.
This is just an open question to anyone. Supposedly, when George Romney was running for president, Ezra Taft Benson was really pushing President McKay to allow him to start a third party. And I just wondered if anybody had any experience with the fact that maybe he didn't have that much Mormon support during the election.
Well, he wasn't trying to start a third party. What Ezra Taft Benson wanted to do is he was asked to be George Wallace's running mate on the American Independent Party ticket in 1968, and Benson went to McKay, and McKay put the kibosh on that, ended up sending him to Europe, I understand, right after that for a second time. But anyway, that's basically what happened, because Wallace, of course, was running an anti-civil rights, ultra-conservative campaign.
Yeah, I'm from Iowa, and I'm a political activist there, and I do think Romney is the front runner. At this point, the Iowa poll and the New Hampshire poll is more, far more important than national polls, and he's ahead in both, and especially in Iowa. And the poll today is extremely important because with Giuliani and McCain not competing in Iowa, it's really George Romney against the rest of the field, and all of whom are in the single digits, usually very low single digits. So the problem, so I think he's going to win it big. However, he could win it fairly large today and still lose, because in those early races, it's the expectation game. In 1984, Mondale had 49% in Iowa. Gary Hart had 16%, and that Hart was clearly the winner. He went on to make a serious challenge to Mondale and, you know, came fairly close to getting the nomination. So a lot's going to depend. If Mitt lost today, it would be terrible, devastating. If he doesn't win big enough that the media think he's won, then it could still not be a victory. So today is really important. But Giuliani has not come in. Not only isn't well organized, he has not come in the state. Romney in the straw poll has a big advantage because he's got huge amounts of money, and none of these other guys do. And in the straw poll, you all come in from all over the state to Ames in the central part of the state, which means much of the state doesn't have very good turnout. The candidates tend to buy your ticket and your transportation. I'm a Democrat, but in 1999, I went to the straw poll just because I wanted to be there, and I teach political science to be there. And so I had let Lamar Alexander buy my way there in exchange for voting for him. And I think I figured out Lamar spent about $95 to get my vote. And he dropped out shortly thereafter.
You had a question, or is that just a comment? Okay. Okay.
I have two questions, but first a comment. I was in a class with Mitt Romney at BYU in 1970, Terry Warner's introduction to philosophy class. I think all of the class would agree he was already running at that point. So the two questions I have are about George. And first of all, how did his what was the chronology behind the between the Detroit riots in July and the statement about being brainwashed on Vietnam? Was
brainwashed statement came in August, late August. I think it was the 30th or 31st of August.
Of 67, so that was...
Yeah, right, about a right month about later. Yeah, it was okay. About a month after the riot.
And the other question was on George Romney's education. We know Mitt's education. I don't know what George's training was.
Well, do you want to answer that, Bonner? George Romney never graduated from college. He attended... He attended college sporadically. He attended, I think, college at the University of Utah, and then he attended college in the East. But he never finished a college degree. I think he had the equivalent of maybe a year or two of college education.
Was he criticized by the newspaper? Certainly a candidate today would be really criticized if he didn't have a formal education. Was that an issue?
Well, only in some of the... I've come across two very strongly anti-Romney biographies that were written... during the campaign when he was the front runner, and this one sneeringly kept referring to him as a college dropout. I mean, about three or four different places. Pretty nasty piece of work. But that's the only place where I've seen that it was brought out was this, I think it was an account written by a former disillusioned aide, or it was written by this, there are two of them. One was written by a former disillusioned aide, and another one was written by, of these two biographies, these two anti-biographies. But I don't remember during the campaign.
I don't remember any. But the reason...
Bonner, go ahead. Come on.
The reason he didn't go to college, the reason he didn't finish, he went to George Washington, he went to the University of Utah sporadically, but the reason is he was chasing Lenore. It was passion again. It was this absolute passion. And he would follow her and go after her, and that dominated everything he did. And that was more important than a college education. And I think she probably was more important than a college education.
Yes. Okay. I'm very much a feminist, and I am aware of his stance on abortion. But my question to you is... twofold. Do you think women's issues are going to come up later, that there's going to be any kind of a swell because of his stance? But also, what is your feeling of his attitudes towards women?
Dennis, why don't you take that one? Come here. I'll let you have that one.
Well, I can tell you that while he was a bishop and while he was a state president in Boston, he was not popular among LDS women. He was considered condescending, and he was very pro-life then. So I always thought that was his true belief. But he's never been sympathetic with women's issues And so if this ever becomes important in the campaign, this could hurt him. It could be interesting to see what a Romney versus Hillary Clinton could be in that light. But then Hillary, of course, can be criticized also because she really is not popular enough with women. Oh, sure.
So you say, but he was Clinton's. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, he's pro-life.
I wonder if you saw the YouTube, I guess it was off mic, but on camera, exchange that he had with the conservative talk host in Iowa. Did any of you see that?
Saw just the little clip,
yeah, right,
that was filmed. Apparently, it was only part of it. We didn't hear all the argument. But did you want to say something about that?
I just wondered how that affected. I thought that was an interesting exchange.
That's the only time I've seen Mitt angry during the campaign. He walked away from him, and
but he didn't walk away from his Mormon beliefs. That's the reason I disagree with John a little bit. In that exchange, he really went out and defended Mormonism.
Yeah.
And he was off camera, had no idea he was being filmed, and he really took it to the day. I thought it was a stand-up job.
Probably so. I didn't see enough of it to be able to speak with any authority.
One of the things in terms of women's issues that I thought was interesting with that little exchange was that he made it very clear that you could be pro-choice and Mormon and a good Mormon, and that he was pro-life, but that it wasn't against his Mormon beliefs to be pro-choice. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, I saw it, and I thought he actually did a pretty good job. I mean, I suppose my complaint would be that that's fantastic when he thinks no one's watching that he defends Mormonism. But, you know, and I don't think that he has contempt for his faith or anything like that. I think he's jumping through the hoops and playing the game that he needs to play to get the Republican nomination, and that may be the case. I mean, I don't think he particularly cares that much about social issues. I think he's saying these things. But the flip-flopping for me has been problematic because it's so extreme to, as governor, support an assault weapons ban and then join the NRA in 2006. You know, I mean, that's pretty clear what he's trying to do. And so I guess that's where my complaint comes from. I understand that the nuance there and that he's in a very difficult position. And I think Dennis is exactly right. He's done a very good job saying, I'm not a spokesman for the Mormon Church. You know, leave me alone. It's not so much that I expect him to be a spokesperson as much as I would hope that he would just at least, when confronted, you know, own his beliefs and then move on the way he has, and he's done a good job with that. But he's in a very difficult position.
John, did you hear him say that he's not running for national pastor?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that
was kind
of an interesting quip.
Right, absolutely. And I agree with that statement. I think it's unfortunate how kind of picked on he's almost been because of that. But then he invites some of it too when he stands up and so willingly. And I mean, so, you know, and he's certainly not the only one guilty of it, but somebody has to tell these people about the invention of videotape. I mean, you know, just stand up there and say, you know, I mean, he's on record saying, you know, I had this family member who died because of an illegal abortion and I will not waver on that. And then 2 years later he wavers on it and completely changes his mind. So anyway, that's my perspective.
Anybody have any other questions? We got a couple of more minutes. One more question, Phil.
Ann Romney felt so beat up in the senatorial campaign that Mitt ran that
Mitt told me later that she refuses to give any more interviews. I don't know if they've stuck to that or not. I just wondered if any of the panelists had any observations about the role of Anne in the campaign vis-a-vis the role of Lenore in George's campaign.
Well, I've heard it from very good authority that that Anne Romney is in the process of writing, I guess, in conjunction, I guess, working with another author on her own campaign account or a book about her life with Mitt Romney. It's a fairly reliable source that they're supposed to be her autobiography about her problems with MS, as you probably are aware. She's suffering from MS, and then she actually converted to the Mormon Church when she was dating Romney, Mitt Romney. She was not LDS, and so she's working on a biography right now, I guess, and that's supposed to be coming out, I think, in the next few months, by the end of the year. And I've heard that on good authority. I don't know if that really answers your question, Phil, but that anybody else have any insights into Anne Romney?
Yeah, Lenore got George elected governor. Lenore was the best campaigner by far. She ran for the Senate for Michigan herself and didn't win. She was against a popular Democrat. But Lenore is not as good at running for herself, but she was great at supporting George. Anne has declined. I talked to her about that a couple of years ago, and she's declined to take that kind of role. She does submit to certain kinds of interviews. There are really clear conditions, but she does go along with certain ones, make certain kinds of comments, but not the formal interview that Lenore used to do all the time in the formal speeches and so forth. She's a very different person. But George was not good at doing the national campaign. He was really good at the state, at the local level, but he didn't understand what was needed at the national. And Lenore, I think, was one of those reasons. She saw local issues and passionate local kinds of support, but didn't put it in terms of the large national setting, which I think Mitt is trying to do. But I see a clear difference in that respect.
Well, we've come to the end of our time, and I just want to thank you people for coming, and I want to thank our panelists. I think it's been an excellent session, and I really appreciate all these people.